Hey everybody, welcome to another exciting episode of the OIG Roundtable. We have a little bit of a reduced, we're not really at a round table, it's more of like a tray table, TV tray table. Maybe it's a poker, smaller poker table. It's just Wade and I. Matt is actually out, believe it or not, he's actually in New York visiting some of our SIU clients, like physically out and about. So good for Matt to get out of the house. But I've got Wade McFall here. Retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and a manager on our SIU team. And I am still Eric Rubenstein, senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse. And today we want to talk about, and it actually works well with just you and I, Wade, talking, because it's kind of a bridge topic. But, you know, there was an article recently, you know, past 6 months or so, that was brought to light. Someone sent it over my way a couple of days ago from the Wall Street Journal, talking about an analysis that they did in the Medicare Advantage space that is essentially saying that they did a study from 2018 to 2021 on Medicare Advantage related costs and estimate that there's about $50 billion in fraud, waste, abuse payments that are going out. Their analysis shows that it's about a $450 billion program in the Medicare Advantage space. And one of the things that they were talking about is a little bit of the aggressiveness of the payer community for their Medicare Advantage patients going out and manipulating risk scores, right? We know that this is a known area. There are a number of cases that are currently going on with DOJ prosecuting and filing lawsuits. There are some key TAMs. We know recently Cigna, I think it was $170 million in a civil settlement relative to the changing of risk score and things of that sort. And Wade, you know this, when we got hired back in the mid 90s, everybody had said that there was Medicare Advantage was still pretty new. And everybody was saying, hey, there's no fraud. There's no fraud in Medicare Advantage. It's a way to stop fraud because it's what they call PMPM, per member per month, or capitated payments. The provider gets the same amount of money every month, whether he sees the patient once or 100 times. You know, and I think that generally what we've come to think about is that the fraud committed today or the fraud, waste, abuse committed today has a financial effect tomorrow on risk scores and changing risk scores. And I think back when we got started, you know, there was this general feeling that the fraud was always being perpetuated on the provider community, fraud, waste, and abuse, that the carriers weren't really involved in fraud, waste, and abuse. And we're not, you know, while we're not making any sweeping statements about any of the open cases or fraud, waste, abuse, when we read this article, it was really kind of an amazing thing. Parlay onto the fact that, you know, just from a statistics perspective and just from a numbers perspective, as of April of 2024, 67.3 million people were on Medicare. Approximately 90% of those people are age 65 or over. So about 10% are falling into the category of being eligible for Medicare as an entitlement based upon something other than age, right? Because people get Medicare based upon eligibility, and the number one triggering eligibility is age, 65 or over. And then you've got people that fall into some medical conditions, black lung, ESRD, end-stage renal disease, a few other things where you can get Social Security disability. And when you get that, you then qualify for Medicare. But about 90%, are age 65 or over that are getting it. And the thing that's interesting is years ago, Puerto Rico had the highest percentage of its Medicare population in a Medicare Advantage plan, and that is now not the case. Michigan is actually the number one state for the greatest population of people to be on a Medicare Advantage plan. I think Texas, California, New York, Florida are all in that mix as well, which is, you know, are the big five states for population and also, you know, the initial in a lot of the fraud, waste, abuse. When we look around, we always saw that the top five states were always, you know, it was always Florida, New York, Michigan, Texas, California were always the five. So, you know, we're seeing that as a consistency. The other thing I thought was interesting is that with 50.4% of the Medicare population being in a Medicare Advantage plan, that there has been a tectonic growth in Medicare Advantage, where over the past decade, the number of people enrolling into an Advantage plan has doubled in the past 10 years. So, you know, there is a huge shift to try to move people from a cost containment perspective into Medicare Advantage. But obviously, you know, one of the biggest areas within Medicare Advantage on the payer side is going to be the sicker people are, the more it's costing. And so when it costs more, the Medicare program pays those carriers more money. Now, the thing to always remember is that from a fraud, waste, abuse perspective, the member, right, Wade, the member is not spending any additional money. Their Medicare premiums are paid, and the Medicare program pays the insurance carrier to administer and operate the Medicare Advantage plan, and obviously pays more for people that are sicker. And the Wall Street Journal article talked about how some of the insurance plans that are out there were preemptively sending nurses and healthcare professionals out to do essentially home health visits. And they were identifying instances where patients were, you know, had a bunch of comorbidities that were not previously known to the healthcare provider. And, you know, obviously that opens up a whole host of, you know, let's talk at least parlay off of last week's podcast where we talked from a compliance perspective that, you know, you've got this situation now where if a healthcare provider is notified or knows of a certain type of condition, you know, they have to act on it. Now you've got this potential issue where there's a lack of coordination of care. You know, you've got a whole host of potential compliance issues that result from that. And the like. So from a fraud, waste, abuse, compliance perspective, this presents like a huge number of challenges because now you've got essentially battles of the experts. You've got competing medical, potentially medical claims. You know, a patient that a home health agency has diagnosed the patient as having diabetic cataracts when their primary care physician is saying they don't even have diabetes. How could they have diabetic cataracts? So it does present itself with some investigative challenges, particularly if now a provider is in a place where he's like, did I miss something, right? And like the whole host of things that come about as a result of that.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem, part of the problem too is that Medicare gave the insurers the option to just add diagnoses to the patient's chart after reviewing it. And they did that in a couple different ways. As you mentioned, they had nurses go to the residents and do like a home health type visit. But they also used AI, artificial intelligence, to come up with diagnoses without kind of, we always talk about how AI is effective, but it needs like the human intelligence portion to go along with it. So that needs to be, you can't just have it kick out a diagnosis and add it to the chart and move on. You have to do some further investigating. But the problem too is, as you alluded to, is that the primary care physician is hearing about this, you know, down the road, and they wonder if they missed something, or it could be that they're like, you know, who's adding diagnosis to my chart without letting me know, because now it's got tons of different implications for the patient. But I think the biggest problem in this that we're seeing, and it's one of the red flags that we used to always see in OI investigations when it came to like mobile diagnostic testing and different lab types of cases where a service is, whether it's a test or lab service is ordered, but it's never followed up on. So there's never, you know, if you're going to get a test done, you want to find out the results so you can act appropriately and to treat whatever the test is diagnosing. But what we're seeing a lot of these is they're adding things to the chart, diagnoses, and they never follow up on it. So it's not for patient care. It's strictly for profit. And as you also alluded to, that they just by adding certain conditions, obesity, heart conditions, chest pain, kidney disease, certain types of cancer, strokes, it's, you know, that's like another several thousand dollars. But if they're just going to diagnose it and not treat it, it's clear, such as it was great evidence in OI cases, that they're doing that strictly for the profit and not for the patient's well-being in healthcare. And that's what we're right. seeing a lot of in this, where the insurers are adding the diagnosis outside of the doctor's kind of supervision.
Well, and the thing that's interesting is, you know, when we looked at some of the things in the study, we saw that, for example, people with diabetic cataracts, that's a $2,000 or $3,000 bump in risk score money that goes to the payer that's in question. And so you look at that, you know, and you see that, you know, I think the one thing that was talked about was that, you know, for one particular payer, 640 or 50 out of 1,000 or something were, you know, had this condition, when in the traditional Medicare world, it's like some de minimis number. The problem becomes, you know, from an SIU perspective, SIUs, and we talk about this all the time, payment integrity departments, SIUs, program integrity, are oftentimes rocks in hard places because their job is to ferret out fraud, waste, and abuse. But when you are in a payment integrity team and the fraud, waste, or abuse or compliance issue is from within, it creates a challenge, right? Now, you know, when we were at OIG, we had a team of agents that were in DC, the Special Investigations Branch, right? And they were basically the police of the police. For lack of a better term, they were the internal affairs group, and they did, you know, employee-related cases and things of that sort from that law enforcement perspective. And so it's a little bit of less of a heartache because they were put to exist to do that. And we know that a lot of larger SIUs have investigators assigned strictly to internal matters, whether it be conflicts of interest, whether it be time and attendance for employees, whether it be, you know, an employee seeking to get reimbursement for travel, tolls, mileage, something where it may be administrative in nature, where it's a segmented individual thing. But here, one of the challenges is the, you know, the SIU or the payment integrity team is almost now in a weird place because now they know this. What do they do, right? Are you investigating your employer? And like, it creates a lot of challenges. I mean, I think, you know, to an extent, this is where things like KETAMs come in and whistleblowers and anonymous hotlines. This is where making complaints to the OIG can, you know, can kind of get a voice. But, you know, I think there's, you know, the challenges of investigating these things and the challenge of the fact that, you know, what, let's take the diabetic cataracts or let's take diabetes, let's take some of these comorbidities, that one of the challenges is, what if the patient in question hasn't been to their primary care doctor in a year or more? And it is possible. I think most people that are on Medicare are probably regularly visiting at least primary care doctors and or specialists, but there's going to be a percentage of people that just don't get that level of care because of either access or whatever it may be. And so you now run into this kind of competing situation where if you, maybe you do have high blood pressure, you're hypertensive, you have cardiovascular, maybe you are diabetic and you just don't know it. And so, you know, to an extent, there is a quality of care issue here where the payers can clearly say, hey, we're looking to address, you know, one of the big buzzwords now is the social determinants of health, right? That the payers can go out and say, hey, look, we are providing a bridge that didn't exist because the patient wasn't being seen. You know, doctors don't do house calls anymore. And so, you know, there is a fine line between, is this a waste, fraud, abuse, compliance issue, or is this a payer being proactive about making sure that Americans get the best healthcare that they can? You know, we know our morbidity and our mortality rates are not as low as they could be. We know that healthcare in the U.S. doesn't rank as well as it could. And so this becomes an issue, but it certainly presents itself as a wrinkle from an SIU perspective about how to address complaints that come in. Because surely we know from this, and you know, we've had some anecdotal stories where members are reporting this back to their payer. And, yep. You know, like, you know, what do you do with these complaints, right? You still have to vet them out. And that becomes part of that challenge.
Yeah, and the numbers could be, you know, in consideration of how many members there are, but some of the numbers, going back to that diabetic cataract example, there were, let me see here, there was 66,000 Medicare Advantage patients that were diagnosed with diabetic cataracts, even though their cataracts had been replaced with plastic lenses prior. So that's one of those things where it's a anatomically impossible to have cataracts on plastic lenses because your cataracts have been removed. Another 36,000 of those that were diagnosed with these cataracts, diabetic cataracts, had no medical services to follow up, as we talked about earlier, or no prescription drugs related to it. So in these cases, again, that may be a small percentage in comparison to how many members there are, but it's still 66,000 patients, or the other one with no follow-up, 36,000. That's a lot of non-follow-up, prescription drugs. Right. So, and that gets back to going back to the SIU portion. Again, I'm not a data scientist, but this seems to be one of those things where if the cataract was removed and the member has a plastic lens, there should be some kind of edit that could be put in place. And again, this is all in hindsight. Yeah, it makes sense that you would do that. But there might be things that can be done with the data that, you know, that for these medically impossible situations, that maybe there can be, you know, we have all these algorithms that we use. Maybe just more algorithms wouldn't be a bad thing to try and help this kind of situation, although it's a smaller portion.
Well, and you know, what makes this interesting is how is this different than the nefarious DME provider who's billing for bilateral knee braces on a single leg amputee above the knee, right? Or the podiatrist who bills for greater than 5 mycotic nails, which is mycotic is, you know, a toe fungus that requires the intervention of a podiatrist for someone who may have had a gangrenous foot that was amputated from diabetic neuropathy or something, right? This is in that same vein, right? The difference is that it's coming right from the payer, right? So it's almost a similar challenge. And, you know, this is one of those where could CMS do a better job in the data that it collects from the Medicare Advantage plans? We already know that there are some, that there have been historically some challenges in encounter data coming over to CMS on Medicare Advantage. But, you know, one would think that if a person has had a bilateral cataract surgery or singular cataract surgery, and then later on they're diagnosed with diabetic cataracts, that should raise a flag on the CMS side of things, because ultimately CMS is saying, hey, we're paying for this person to have diabetic cataracts. Wait a minute, this person had cataract surgery a year ago. How do they have that? Or you would think it's a little bit of the same thing, like why, this is a rhetorical question, but it's almost like, why isn't there an algorithm, for example, even if we're talking about things in the DME space, if someone has a prior diagnosis of a left leg amputation above the knee, how is it that a claim gets paid for a knee brace for the left side, right? Or someone who's in a wheelchair bilateral amputee? And you see this, we saw that constantly in a lot of the heyday of the DME frauds in the early 2000s. We saw that, you know, constantly. You know, you'd go to someone's house. My favorite would be, you know, you'd knock on the door, and the person would come to the door and they were on crutches and they were missing a leg, you know, or they were in a wheelchair and they were missing two legs. And they're like, can I help you? Yes, I'd like to talk to you about the knee braces you got. I'm above the knee amputee. Like, what are you talking about? Right. So it's in that, it's in that same vein. It is a challenge, but I think from the payer side, you know, if in fact the payers are identifying individuals, because this is the thing that we don't know from the article. This wasn't researched. And I would be curious to know this. How are the people that the payers are sending, you know, these are clearly going to be contracted organizations that go out, nurses and the like. I would be very curious to know how are the patients that are being selected being identified? And what is it in the data that is making them rise to the top to have such a visit? And my question would be, you know, if there are legitimate things within that, and then as a result of that, is there somebody who hasn't been to their doctor in 2 years? And maybe their diagnosis 2 years ago or a year ago was borderline diabetes or type 1 diabetes or even type 2 diabetes. And in the year, they've not been to a doctor. Meaning there's no orders for, you know, even if you aren't on medication, your doctor could order you to test your sugar, and you would therefore theoretically have a meter and strips and all of that, right? So the fact that there may not be any medication, there's a lot of other collateral things. If 2 years ago someone was diagnosed with borderline diabetes or diet controlled diabetes, and there's nothing in the record that shows that they've been to the doctor in a year or two, now we're talking about some of those things that impact social determinants of health, right? And we see, if you do a lot of research on this in the SDOH world, CMS is capturing a lot of this data because it really does have to do with, at the end of the day, quality of care, access to care, and the like. So, you know, I think if I'm on the payer side, I'm going to dispute a lot of what the Wall Street Journal article said, because I'm going to go back and say, look, we're running algorithms for patient quality of care and health and all of that stuff. And it's a positive. And I think getting back to a lot of what we talk about from the investigative and SIU perspective, this is one of those examples where you have to really have the ability to converse with different people in different departments within your organization, because you have to be able to understand, what is this diagnosis code? What does this mean? What does this tell us about the patient? And interacting with payment integrity, medical direction, education and training, right? We can't live in a bubble in the SIU space, right? Having those relationships helps to understand what is it that's going on with this patient when you're looking at just a billing history, right? Because the data can tell you a lot of things. But as I love to say, and my dear mentor, Jason Eisengrim, will always argue with me, but I always say, data lies until you've proved it one way or another, right? This is a great example where you've got to have people who know a lot more about these things than we as investigators do.
Yeah, and another angle that I think I was kind of unclear after reading the article, the Wall Street Journal article, was kind of the mechanics of how this works as far as the nurses go out to the residents and they look at the chart, they make some determinations, they diagnose something. You know, how is that? Well, and apparently it's not getting back to the physician, because the one that they interviewed, I forget what his practice was, but he didn't, it's not like they're sending him an updated, hey, we think you want to look at this diagnosis, you may have missed something, or maybe something has progressed since you last saw them. He was finding out about all these added diagnoses like months or even years later. So it, again, it goes back to like the whole continuum of care, that if they're seeing something that maybe wasn't diagnosed before, and if they catch it, that's their argument that's why this is such a great system. If that's really the case, how are they letting the primary care physician know about this so that it can be added to the plan of care? Another one of the stats that they gave on this was related to HIV, kind of as a side note, but they were saying less than 17% of the insured diagnosed members with HIV were on antiretroviral medications, and anybody who's diagnosed with HIV should be on those, and less than 17% of them were. So that's another example of, oh, it's great that you're diagnosing something, but we really have to question the validity of the diagnosis and what you're doing with it. If you diagnose it and leave it in a folder and don't do anything with it, you might as well not be diagnosing it, except for the fact that you're getting paid a lot more money for it. It's the bottom line.
Right. So, and that is the challenge. The challenge is that on the provider side, when a provider is informed of a potential diagnosis or an actual diagnosis or whatever, that they have to act on it. The one example that I was giving you beforehand is, I have celiac disease, so no gluten. So I don't get to enjoy life the way most people do when it comes to eating things. But, you know, what was interesting was, a couple of years ago, I was having some stomach problems and I went for a test and they found, what ultimately was a benign nothing cyst on a kidney that by the time I had my ultrasound, it had gone away, but it showed up on a CT. And my gastroenterologist did not want to write the order for the ultrasound, because his reasoning was, I'm a gastroenterologist, if I write this order, I own the problem. And he didn't want to write it because he didn't want to have to deal with it. And my response was, write me the order for the ultrasound, I'm going to go to a urologist, but I'd love to know, is this a benign cyst? Is this cancer? Like, what is this? Before I can get in with the urologist. And he ultimately did it. And I went to a urologist, it was nothing. But, you know, I kind of understand that. Like, a doctor doesn't want to order something that they then have to deal with. And kind of collaterally, I had worked years ago when I was at the OIG. I worked on a case involving a blood lab that was sneaking in a test called amylase to their comprehensive panel. And amylase is not part of a traditional comprehensive panel. It has to be built separately. And what they did was they put it in, they buried amylase into the list of tests that they were doing. And then when it was reported, they actually buried it into the middle of all the tests. So you didn't really see it. And, you know, when we went and talked to a bunch of doctors, they were like, I would never even order this. It's a rarely ordered test. And some doctors were actually annoyed because they missed it. They didn't see it. And it turns out on some of these tests, some of these people actually had elevated amylase levels. And while most doctors are like, yeah, there's really not much to do about it, some doctors are like, the problem is that now that I know about it, I have to treat it or it's potentially malpractice. So you've got all of these like collateral things that are going on. Do these people have these conditions? Are they not? I think it's, you know, from the one perspective, being diabetic, hypertensive, high blood pressure, right? Cardiovascular conditions. Those are things that people can have and not know they have them. Similarly, you know, maybe you have HIV and you just don't know it because you've been otherwise healthy. You haven't been sick. Maybe, you know, it's a new diagnosis. You haven't been to a doctor. There's so many pieces of this puzzle that from an investigative perspective can really present challenges. But I certainly think that if I'm on the payer side, I'm going to say vociferously, this is our way of being able to actually control costs. Because if we are able to identify that Wade McFall has diabetes today, it's way better to be able to get you into where you need for care, treatment, and cost containment than 3 or 4 years from now when you're suffering diabetic neuropathy. You now need podiatric care because you've got a gangrenous foot. So that's twice I used gangrene in the proper terminology in a podcast. But, you know, there are a bunch of collateral things where if I am on the ropes as a payer and I am being questioned about this, my argument is going to be social determinants of health. I am looking to ensure quality care, access to care, and longevity of my patient population by doing this. And I think that there's a lot of back and forth. So while the Wall Street Journal article, I think to you and me, was an interesting read, it certainly is only one side of the coin because it really didn't talk about what are some of the positive collateral effects of identifying some of these, you know, of identifying some of these conditions. But the data, you know, this is where you've got to have people that know the data and be able to understand it. And how does that all intertwine back into the issue at hand? So, you know, interesting stuff. We see these kind of articles all the time. And when we read them at first blush, I think, you know, when I get them, you get them, Matt, whoever gets them, we look at them, we kind of read them. And then once we digest them a little bit more and we start to talk about them, we realize, hey, this might not be a fraud, waste, and abuse compliance issue at first read. But when you start to dive into it a little bit more, it becomes a little bit more interesting from our perspective. So, you know, these articles are great. We love when people send them to us. So keep them coming. It's good stuff. So as always, Waits, it's good to have quality time with you. I feel like this
That's right.
Personal quality time. So it's always a good time. Matt, we miss you. We'll see you next week. And for everybody tuning in again, we appreciate your support. We're close to 36,000 followers on LinkedIn. And so thanks very much for that. For those of you that are following us on LinkedIn but not getting our newsletter, you can just go to our website. You can get our newsletter right on the splash page, advisehealth.com. You can get that newsletter every Friday sent right to your inbox, as well as going to our YouTube channel. And, of course, our LinkedIn Lives that are coming out every month and the sort. So YouTube, Spotify, you can get all the recorded sessions. As always, we appreciate everybody taking care for this. Just so everybody knows, you know, while we do these for release in our newsletters on Friday and we release them on Thursdays on LinkedIn, we actually record these a day or two before. Today happens to be September 11th. And for those who were there or for those who dealt with it, this is obviously a very sad day. So I will stop there because it is a depressing day. We shouldn't talk about it. for anything other than recognizing the sacrifices that people made. So 9/11 is an important day, and I think it's important that if we record something, we talk about it. So everybody, again, thanks for tuning in to this week, and we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.